Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and welcome to How the Supreme Court Rewrote the Constitution. This is part three, entitled The Court on the Brink. There's a common myth that President Franklin D. Roosevelt proposed his 1937 court packing plan because the Supreme Court struck down all his New Deal programs. The truth was that the court often upheld his New Deal programs. What annoyed FDR was that the court refused to rubber stamp all of them. One New Deal victory, in fact a triple victory, came in the Gold Clause cases. These were decided on February 18, 1935. Congress and the president had devalued the dollar relative to gold, repudiated federal promises to repay debts in gold, substituting paper money instead, and even banned private contract terms requiring payment in gold. The idea was to provoke inflation, which they thought would help the economy. This financial manipulation didn't help the economy much, if at all. A primary effect was to benefit corporations issuing gold bonds at the expense of retirees and annuitants who relied on those bonds for household income. Although the government's measures were foolish and cruel, truth to say, they weren't unconstitutional. The Constitution's Coinage Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, grants the federal government very broad power to manipulate the currency. The court got some of its reasoning wrong, but its result, upholding the government's actions, was constitutionally correct. Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes's 5-4 majority opinion did make it clear, however, that it would be unconstitutional for the government to repudiate its obligations entirely. But the New Dealers lost the next round. Their National Industrial Recovery Act, or NIRA, empowered the president to license companies to impose anti-competitive codes governing their respective industries. The National Industrial Recovery Act was based largely on an Italian fascist model adopted by Benito Mussolini, a character then admired by many American progressives. On May 27, 1935, the justices unanimously struck down the NIRA, even the progressive justices. The case was ALA Schechter Poultry Corporation versus United States, sometimes called the sick chicken case. Writing for his colleagues, Chief Justice Hughes concluded that the NIRA exceeded the congressional power to regulate interstate commerce. Further, he ruled that the NIRA delegated power to the president without necessary guidelines. Next came United States versus Butler. This was issued on January 6, 1936. It was a mixed result for the Roosevelt administration. At issue was the constitutionality of a New Deal farm subsidy program. The 6-3 decision was composed by Justice Owen Roberts. It had two principal sections. The first section of the Roberts opinion said that the Constitution's taxation clause, that's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, the Constitution's taxation clause, he said, granted Congress almost unlimited authority to spend for the general welfare. The second section of his opinion contained the actual decision of the court, and that decision was that the farm subsidy program violated the 10th Amendment and was therefore unconstitutional. The first section, the general welfare section, was very poorly researched. Roberts examined contradictory statements by only two founders, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, and he accepted Hamilton's version. But he failed to note that Hamilton's version had been issued for political convenience after the Constitution was ratified. He also failed to note that this version was inconsistent with public representations that Hamilton had made before the Constitution was ratified. And it was also inconsistent with the views of just about every other founder. The Constitution certainly didn't grant Congress unbridled authority to spend money for the general welfare. The conclusion of the court in the second section, didn't follow from the first. This is the one that said that the 10th Amendment invalidated the farm subsidy program. The 10th Amendment says that powers not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states and the people. But if, as the first section of the Roberts opinion claimed, the Constitution grants Congress power to spend whatever it wants, then the farm subsidy program was within Congress's delegated powers, and the 10th Amendment didn't even apply. The result in the Butler case cost the New Deal a farm program. On the other hand, the administration was to make profitable use of the court's general welfare language. The next important case came out on May 18, 1936. It was the fractured decision in Carter versus Carter Coal Company. The court addressed Congress's power to regulate commerce among the several states. This is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution, the famous Commerce Clause. The majority ruled that this power wasn't broad enough to permit Congress to control coal production. Justice George Sutherland, writing for a 5-justice majority, correctly pointed out that production isn't included in the Constitution's meaning of commerce. Regulating production, meaning manufacturing, mining, agriculture, is the state's job. Balancing defeat in Carter Coal was FDR's victory in the case of United States versus Curtis Wright Export Corporation. This was decided on December 21, 1936. Again, George Sutherland wrote the opinion, and this time the court was unanimous. It ruled that when the president conducts foreign affairs, he's not limited to the powers the Constitution grants him. The president has additional authority inherited from the Continental and Confederation Congresses of 1775 through 1789. Justice Sutherland's rationale is called the Doctrine of Inherent Sovereign Authority. This doctrine had been kicking around since the founding, and the 10th Amendment actually was passed to kill it. In fact, the court recognized that just a few decades earlier. But that didn't seem to bother any of the justices in 1936. They concluded their balancing act with National Labor Relations Board versus Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation, issued on April 12, 1937. The issue in the case was whether Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce is wide enough to allow Congress to regulate labor relations in a huge interstate corporation. This case also was 5-4, with Chief Justice Hughes writing for the majority, and he said, yes, the commerce power is wide enough to regulate labor relations in a huge interstate corporation. He admitted that labor relations are part of production rather than of commerce, but he said labor unrest in a giant interstate firm could cause serious disruption to interstate commerce. The Commerce Clause, he argued, gave Congress power to guard against this kind of disruption. Writers on constitutional law almost always overlook three crucial aspects of the Jones and Laughlin case. The first is that it was obviously a compromise. Hughes's opinion allowed Congress to regulate labor relations in large interstate companies, but not in smaller intrastate companies. Second, careful reading of the opinion showed that it relied more on the Constitution's Necessary and Proper Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. It relied more on the Necessary and Proper Clause than on the Commerce Clause. And third, Hughes' opinion misapplied the Necessary and Proper Clause. I'll explain all of this in the fifth installment of this series. The balancing act that the court had been engaging in, ruling for the New Deal sometimes and against the New Deal other times, ended a month after the Jones and Laughlin case, with the announcement that conservative Justice William Van Deventer was retiring. Recall that in United States versus Butler, the agricultural subsidy case, the court said that Congress could spend money on any program it wished for the general welfare. Because that wasn't part of the court's actual decision and technically contradicted it, No reputable lawyer would consider those comments to be binding precedent. Yet, in the case of Helvering versus Davis, issued on May 24, 1937, Justice Benjamin Cardozo treated those comments as precedent. He announced that Congress's power to spend for any general welfare purpose was, quote, now settled by decision. He added that any reasonable doubts as to whether a spending program furthered the general welfare would be left to Congress. Only two justices dissented, James McReynolds and Pierce Butler. Justice Sutherland returned to his progressive roots by joining the majority. Justice Cardozo also wrote the opinion in Stewart Machine Company versus Davis, which was issued the same day as Helvering versus Davis. The Constitution requires that direct taxes be allocated or apportioned among the states by population. Direct taxes is a technical term that applies to levies upon land and property and income and many other subjects. Stewart Machine upheld a direct Social Security tax on employers' use of labor. Congress hadn't bothered to apportion it among the states. So Justice Cardozo pretended that this levy was an excise and therefore an indirect tax. In fact, an excise is not a tax on labor, it's a tax on consumption. Cardozo disregarded this, relying instead on precedents that didn't support his conclusion. In a perfect world, Justice Cardozo's dishonest decisions in Helvering and Stewart Machine would have sullied his stellar reputation. However, the people who established the reputations of jurists, and most of them who write books on the Supreme Court, generally share his left-of-center philosophy, so they give him a pass. What are the practical consequences of Butler, Helvering, and Stewart Machine? Those practical consequences were devastating. Before those decisions, Congress usually balanced its budget or ran a surplus. In the 85 years since, Congress has rarely balanced its budget, and the size of the deficits continues to accelerate. Furthermore, as Justice Butler predicted in his Stewart Machine dissenting opinion, these decisions enabled Congress to bribe states with their citizens' own money. This undermined state independence and weakened a crucial check in the constitutional system. Removing limits on the federal spending power also created a mob of special interests that pursue federal dollars irrespective of the public interest. Because those special interests fund congressional reelection campaigns, cooperative members of Congress can remain in office for decades. Since the 1960s, moreover, the Supreme Court has used its unfettered spending authority to create dependency, fund favored political causes, promote fringe social theories, and undermine traditional culture. The Supreme Court's next attacks on the Constitution came in the case of United States versus Caroline Products, issued in 1938, and United States versus Miller, issued in 1939. I'll address them in the essay discussing civil liberties.